You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. After decades of debate, it is now common knowledge that the world is in the midst of an ever-increasing energy crisis, and that the long era of burning fossil fuels for power is contributing to our own demise. And yet, the transition to alternative energy is proving to be more complex than you might think. The Harper's Magazine article Boomtown examines the solar land rush currently happening in the American West, specifically in the town of Beatty in Nye County, Nevada. The Nye County area has the capacity to produce enough energy through its prospective solar farms to power the entire planet. Yes, the entire planet. Close to the entrance of Death Valley National Park, it's an area rife with flat land and almost endless sunlight. But residents are pushing back on proposals to use its land for this purpose. After a series of exploitative boom-bust cycles, like the gold rush, residents are opposing the plan on ecological and economic grounds. They argue that covering Nevada in solar panels will affect wildlife, recreational spaces, and the town's future. The article asks the difficult questions of who should sacrifice for our collective future and at what cost. My guests today are deep into this inquiry. Dustin Mulvaney is a solar expert and professor of environmental studies at San Jose State University, and he collaborated on the Harper's article. But first, the author of Boomtown, Hilary Angelo. Angelo is an urban environmental sociologist and associate professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She is also a current member of the Institute for Advanced Study, where she is working with other scholars on the issue of climate crisis politics. I wanted to know how her work in urban sociology was related to sustainability and the growing issue of water scarcity.
I do a lot of work on urban sustainability and sustainability planning in general. And so a lot of questions about how human settlement relates to the external environment. So one of my interests in this topic and in these questions about energy is, are we making the same decisions again as we now confront this new environmental crisis? Because much like we've done with water, you know, we sort of created these very large-scale infrastructure systems in the 20th century that made huge quantities of water available to, you know, people who lived in cities in Los Angeles and elsewhere, and we're now confronting the unsustainabilities of those decisions, especially as the West gets drier. And so, yeah, I think there's a kind of similar dynamic that's happening now. Obviously, we're not going to run out of sun, but we will run out of land, or, you know, we can be making different choices about how to use these resources.
You know, when I was out there, it was like, you know, people desperate, a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of pronouncements, and then it would abate and it would go away again for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But when I read your article, I mean, now we pivot from that to Nevada. Beatty is the city. Nye County is the general area. And I don't want to use the word NIMBY because that to me bespeaks rich, privileged people who don't want things in their vista that are necessary and they want to impose them on other people. I don't view those people as NIMBY. How do you describe those residents there?
Yeah. I mean, it's nice of you not to use the term. When I initially heard that there were people in the desert protesting solar development, I also sort of thought or assumed that they were NIMBYs, you know, or that is the framework that we're used to thinking about these issues, which is a question of sort of, you know, private property or private interests versus questions of public good. When I met these people, I mean, I think what I found so interesting about them and what made me write the article is that I felt they were actually trying to make this very important critique that has more to do with what you were just talking about like the, for example, the choices we made about water and other natural resources in the 20th century. Basically, they were saying, this is a question of how we do social change. And we're claiming that climate change is this moment of large-scale social transformation, but actually from our perspective, from their perspective, we're making the same decisions about land use, about infrastructure development, and so on. So I thought that kind of critique that was being made doesn't fit into how we understand NIMBYs. Public land in the United States is a commons or could be described as a commons, which isn't a vocabulary that we use in the U.S. very much, but people talk about it. There's sort of similar fights about renewable energy development in Latin America and Africa, and people use the term energy grabbing. Like, so they sort of talk about this common land being taken by energy companies and the implications that has for rural livelihoods. And so I think that is actually much more similar to what's going on in the American West now.
You know, here in New York, where, as everybody knows, you know, Robert Moses condemns and through eminent domain takes whole neighborhoods in the Bronx so we can build a highway. New York City, in cooperation with the state, seized to eminent domain valleys of land that they evicted everybody from and flooded them to make the reservoir system for the city's drinking water. Mm-hmm. But in the area of Nevada you were in, do they view it purely as another rush? Companies coming in, private companies, to alter the landscape, do they see it as a critical element, potentially, in something that we all have to make some sacrifices for and some contribution, which is to address climate change?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I think some of them do and some of them probably don't, right? For some people, there is a very personal, emotional reaction that any of us would have, right, if the government was coming and seizing land or, you know, building, flooding a valley and putting a reservoir in your backyard or that kind of thing. They describe themselves as fighting for their lives. So that, I think often in that framework, it doesn't sort of rise to the level of the public good questions. But, you know, one thing I would say is that even within that, like even when we start thinking in those terms about, you know, what is in the national interest or the public interest here and how should these public lands be used, like there's a real question about what the highest and best use is. So, for example, in the West, there was a period of time when valleys were being flooded for reservoirs, right? So, I mean, there have been shifts in kind of American public consciousness and sentiment about these issues over time in terms of saying to themselves, well, you know, the thing that's really in the public interest is to have this reservoir here versus the thing that's in the public interest is to save this, you know, beautiful valley so that we can have that as part of our heritage.
These fish stocks.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I think what I find complicated about this question is that that's an open question, right? There's a climate crisis and we have to decarbonize, but there's also an extinction crisis and a biodiversity crisis. And so one can argue that preserving desert habitat is, you know, is also an important part of responding to climate change.
So if you have where you mentioned in the article that 85% of the land mass in the state of Nevada is federal land.
Yeah.
And is all of that controlled by BLM?
Basically, yes. Right. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for people who are listening, is Beatty and Nye County, is that on federal land that they're allowed to occupy or are they in private land?
It's federal land. So Beatty is a town that they describe as sort of landlocked. So it's a little island of, you know, people have owned parcels of land and then it's surrounded by public land. Mm-hmm. And for people who are listening, so public lands managed mostly by the Bureau of Land Management, which is a Department of the Interior, sometimes the Forest Service and other things. And they're managed under what's called the multiple use mandate, which means these lands, unlike national parks, are open for extractive activities or energy development as well as recreation. And it's actually 1 in 10 acres of land in the United States, which I found amazing just to learn. So, yeah, so it's a little island of a regular town where people own properties surrounded by this public land.
When did the people of Nye County get introduced to this rush?
Basically now. It's happening now. So there was a sort of initial solar rush, or, you know, phase one of the solar rush, which is about 10 years ago. And Dustin Mulvaney, who you'll be speaking to later today, has been studying that, so can talk about this over a longer time scale. But much of that took place in California. And so the people I mentioned in the article, Kevin and Laura, who run a nonprofit called Basin and Range Watch, they have been part of a group of sort of Western desert advocates and desert protectors, who include people trained in conservation biology and that kind of thing, but also many tribes and indigenous groups and activists and artists and kind of other people who care about the desert for various reasons. And so they started arguing, you know, 10 years ago that renewable energy development of this sort of large scale on what is called undisturbed lands, was going to threaten deserts and was a problem. It's just come to Beatty kind of now, and it's come because there's a new transmission line that's going to be built around the state of Nevada. So it's a big triangle, and that's going to, you know, help carry renewable energy, but also fossil fuel-based energy probably, and export that to other states. So the solar developers are kind of following where these transmission lines are likely to be.
Now, knowing as we do that, similar to the water crisis, there's a clock ticking here in terms of climate change and global warming. And I'm wondering what you think, what it's going to take for us to have, I never use the word Manhattan Project because that bespeaks war. I do tend to use the word Apollo Project, where we're going to really, the government's going to get serious about spending money on these projects, not waiting for private developers to do it. What do you think it's going to take?
What an excellent question. I think we're all asking that question right now.
Right.
Yeah. And to be clear, just since you were talking about some of, like, sort of where nationally we're going to be putting renewable energy development, right? Most energy experts agree that we're going to need some, you know, large scale, utility scale solar and wind and renewables. So this is not an argument against large scale solar per se. It's a question about where we put it and how we're building it out. Human settlements are all kind of unsustainable in their own ways, right? So some cities need water brought to them. Some cities need food brought into them, like New York. So it's not also to say that, you know, we've made a terrible mistake creating cities in the Southwest. I mean, I think there's a few things that are missing right now. So one is we don't really have good frameworks for large-scale planning in the United States. And I sort of mentioned this, I think, in the article in passing, probably in one sentence. But there isn't, other than the Bureau of Land Management, which isn't really staffed or funded for playing this kind of role, there is not a federal agency that can make really big coordinated decisions about land use. Seems very important. So there are, you know, there are planned energy corridors. Like, so there's a... They know where these transmission lines are likely to go. There was some federal planning around that, but there's absolutely no coordination between different types of activities related to renewables. So lithium, geothermal, solar farms, all that can kind of happen in the same place. All those permits are assessed separately. The planning of transmission lines and location of substations takes place separately from questions about where to put actual solar farms. So all of these things are happening in this really piecemeal way that makes it hard to make good decisions. And I think also the role that the federal government is playing is one of kind of lowering barriers to private development, right? They've tried to make it easier for many good reasons for private developers to build out solar, to build out renewables, to reduce the financial risks that those companies are taking on to do it, which is good in terms of facilitating, you know, solar happening quickly. It is not as good in terms of helping guide projects to the best locations or having these kinds of big picture questions in mind, right? So the federal government could be making decisions like, should this land in central Nevada be part of our 25 by 25 initiative, which is the goal to build out 25 gigawatts of solar by 2025 on public lands, or the 30
by... Are they on target for that?
They're trying to be, yeah. But there's also at the same time a 30 by 30 initiative, which is to conserve 30% of the land mass in the United States as, you know, and whatever they call it, you know, intact habitat. And so should this land in Nevada be part of the energy sort of portfolio or part of the conservation portfolio? I mean, those are the kinds of questions that I think the federal government could be stepping in to help answer.
You're an urban sociologist.
Mm-hmm.
Describe for our listeners what that is.
Yeah. So I usually say I'm an urban and environmental sociologist. And so a lot of my work is about ideas about nature and the environment and how we mobilize them when making decisions about the built environment, about cities. So before I got my PhD, I worked for the New York City Parks Department, actually. So
where are you from originally?
I'm actually from Kentucky.
You're from Kentucky.
But I went to college near here. I went to Vassar.
I went to Vassar.
Yeah, in the Hudson Valley.
And then you got your PhD.
At NYU.
At NYU. Yeah.
So I worked here in city government and then I stayed here. I worked for a program called Partnerships for Parks that was actually a public-private partnership, but it basically exists to get communities involved in their city parks and to advocate for them and to also help the Parks Department work better with the public.
I first moved here in 79 to go to NYU.
Okay.
And then the Conservancy emerged, and there was all this brief, as I recall, debate about what union labor or city workers who worked there, how much were they being usurped by this private group. Now we have this quasi-private public marriage of the two. I mean, Central Park is like a business now.
It is. And, you know, this actually relates to the other things we're talking about. I mean, it's a double-edged sword.
Right.
In the West, I mean, national parks are much like Central Park, right? National parks, as many people know, are these like very controlled spaces. You're shuttled from here to there. They're super crowded. There's lots of infrastructure, bathrooms, internet.
It's for tourists.
Public lands are like the interstitial spaces were. I mean, I will just say, so coming from California, there's a lot of state parks there. They don't allow dogs in state parks. So it was the middle of COVID, and I got a dog when I moved to California from New York because I didn't know what else to do with my time. And so I discovered public lands because it was a place you could take your dog. You can take your dog, you can shoot guns, you can ride motorized vehicles, you can live there, you can camp for 14 days without a permit. It's a really kind of interesting and amazing place. Again, just because as an urbanite and a coastal urbanite, I really had no sense that this land existed in the United States and that it still exists. And it's not to say that it's a free-for-all, but those are the kinds of questions that are coming up now about these landscapes, I think, in a similar way. And the changes in parks in New York, I think, can show us how public relationships to these spaces changes so dramatically, right? Central Park went from being a dangerous place that was not particularly valued or was seen as like a liability.
Don't go in the park.
Right.
Like the park was dangerous.
Right.
It was viewed as a very dangerous space.
Yeah, now it's like the mall.
Yeah, it is the mall.
No offense, Central Park.
No, love Central Park.
Urban and environmental sociologist Hilary Angelo. If you are interested in conversations about energy sources and our future, be sure to check out my episode with journalist Nicholas Niarchos, who investigated the cobalt rush in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Just like chatting with this kid, Zicky, he was working in mines since he was 3, basically. And then there was this moment where I showed him my phone. I said, the new iPhone is going for $1,200. And everybody there knows it's going into batteries. Something like 50% of the cobalt mine there just goes into lithium-ion batteries. How do you feel about this? And he was just like, I feel terrible. And I think he sort of thought, you know, how can people sort of sanction such violence against people like me?
Hear more of my conversation with Nicholas Niarchos at heresthething.org. After the break, Hilary Angelo proposes new ways of thinking for the solar model.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. LifeLock monitors and alerts you to identity threats you may miss on your own, even if you're careful with your personal information. And if you do become the victim of tax-related identity fraud, LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists ready to help solve identity theft issues on your behalf. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Why wait for your tax refund in vain? Help protect your information immediately with LifeLock. Go to LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 25% your first year. That's 25% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Identity theft protection starts here.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. For her article on the solar boom in the West, Hilary Angelo dug deep into the history of the area and the exploitation of its land. I wanted to know if places like Nye County were deemed off-limits for development, what spaces might be used instead.
Yeah, it's a great question. People talk about locating large-scale solar on disturbed lands. That's what they call these. So this is sort of industrial, I think, in terms of things like brownfields. So, yeah, where there was a factory and it's polluted. They talk about areas where there was strip mining in Appalachia. So often prisons.
Mountaintop.
Yeah, mountaintop. So often prisons come to those regions now because they're sort of, you know, undesirable land uses. People don't want prisons near their houses. But it's also not the best thing for a community in Appalachia, right? Maybe you'd prefer to have a solar farm than a prison. There's also farmland. This is in California. So exhausted farmland that can't be used for farming anymore, or that they don't have water to farm on anymore. Right. Like, that's another good place for it. So yeah, I think those are all possible.
Now, the energy that could be accessed by the residents of Nye County doesn't have to be part of a solar farm that they're constructing. You could literally, in the bargaining, say, you're going to build us our own solar farm. In other words, we're going to have free energy for everybody that lives here, free, mm-hmm. for the rest of our lives. And that's the gift you're going to give us in exchange for us not getting in the way of your project. When you say this energy goes elsewhere, that's the reality. It goes elsewhere. They don't get it. They don't get to wet their beak, as we say in the mafia.
It's tricky to answer that question. Mm-hmm. It does, like, the very simple way that it could be stated is, yeah, it goes elsewhere. This is like large-scale renewable energy being generated to send and be purchased by companies.
Phoenix.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, as I've heard the Bureau of Land Management and other people say, like, once you get the electrons in the transmission line, you can't really parse it out in those ways. So mm-hmm. there is a, you know, obviously there is local energy being generated and used in Beatty. So I assume they get some of it. Mm-hmm. But it feels like
maybe they should get more of it.
Yeah, I don't think, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, again, the bigger question for them is, what is the economy of this town? And for them, this kind of tourism model seems to have a better long-term future for them. And it makes them less reliant on a company that may be kind of here today, gone tomorrow. Renewable energy, not just solar, but also things like lithium and geothermal. Like, there's a lot of speculation. You know, it's a new industry. And so there are many companies that are trying to get their hands in it. And some of them are good and stable, and some of them are not. And so I think they worry about, you know, becoming a new company town, basically. And then the company folds. And then.
Do you like riding?
I do like riding. Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm not saying this to be kind. What really hooked me was that this is such so well written, this piece you did. I mean, your writing is just fantastic. And I'm an old Harper's junkie. Louis Lapham is an old friend of mine. And I don't mean old chronologically, but he's old chronologically too. But he's a dear friend of mine. So I'm a big Harper's reader. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a book. So I'm working on a book on public lands and the energy transition. So basically looking at the future of public lands in some ways that we've just talked about. Like, basically, climate change is this moment of large-scale transformation. Old infrastructure systems are crumbling. Old ways of doing life on Earth are crumbling. And we're building a bunch of new systems. So I'm curious about, you know, how that's happening and whether we are actually able to kind of change the way we do things, change the political economy, change the relationship to the environment in fundamental ways. I just want to say one thing. I'm going to invite myself to say one thing before we sign off, which is, you know, as an urban sociologist, a lot of what my work was about was looking at kind of the decisions we made in the name of nature that were not sound decisions environmentally, right? Like, we often oppose housing construction because we want to preserve open space. But in not building housing, we push people out, out and out and out. We increase commuting. We increase emissions.
Sprawl.
Right. We fragment habitats, you know, and that kind of thing. So I think this is a similar thing, right? Like, we need to decarbonize. We need to do it fast. We're in the middle of climate crisis. But there are multiple There are, you know, competing issues here, including habitat and biodiversity crisis. And in using this land for solar, I think we are sort of failing to think about the big picture of all of the environmental challenges that we're currently facing and different ways to solve them.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Institute for Advanced Studies scholar Hilary Angelo. My next guest, San Jose State University Professor Dustin Mulvaney, is the author of Solar Power, Innovation, Sustainability, and Environmental Justice, and he's also a source for the article Boomtown. I was curious to learn what the people of Nye County know and understand about our climate crisis timeline and the sacrifice that is being asked of them.
I do think that these communities have a long history with extractive industries, and I think that that's the lens through which they're interpreting a lot of the land use change that might be coming their way and is already coming their way for solar development. You know, these folks who live out there tend to be very tuned into the natural world, so to speak, the desert ecosystem, and they know things are changing. I have a sense that they're familiar with the climate change overarching challenge that we're all facing. I think that they just have had these experiences where when, let's say, you know, a major city like Las Vegas or Los Angeles needs a dump, they go to the desert. When they need lithium like they need today, where do they go? They go to the desert. Where do they need, in this case, lots of sunshine. You know, they feel like their resources are being somewhat squandered in the sense that they also look around and see areas that are disturbed, meaning they're not just living in these rural areas that are rich ecosystems. They're living in a rich ecosystem that also has pockets of extractivism all over it. There's mining all over the California desert. There has been for a long time.
What are they mining for now, primarily?
There's gold mining. There's silver mining. In Nevada, there's new mining projects that are being proposed in and around the area where the solar development's happening as well. Lithium mining, we have somewhere on the order of, last I checked, it was something like 17,000 placer claims for lithium in the state of Nevada, which is, you know, lithium, that's another major challenge, right? We don't right now have the supplies of lithium to get to the electrification of vehicles that we are hoping to see in the future. So I guess the way I think some of these communities are seeing what they're being asked to sacrifice here, they see it as somewhat of a false choice. Because if you zoom out of the Mojave Desert and the areas of the Colorado Desert, which is, you know, Southern California, if you zoom out, there's a lot of agriculture there. You know, if you look at Blythe, a major city on the Colorado River, they're growing lots of alfalfa for export for horses. Now, those are opportunities to site solar farms in these agricultural areas, the Imperial Valley.
So in an area where there's a lot of agriculture, the solar is built adjacent to that? It's land that they're not farming? In other words, what are the conditions there that makes it less problematic for them?
Well, the key thing is the habitat. So, you know, when we're talking about the controversies in this particular region of California and Nevada, the controversies are usually around the public lands. And these public lands have been in conservation by default because they have never been developed. So that means that they're very good habitat for desert tortoise, which we've, you know, lost almost 90% of that population of that animal, that species that's been in that area since there were saber-toothed cats, right? That species has been there for a long time. And now we're were damaging its habitat. So when a solar farm is sited in agricultural areas, it's usually a decision made by that farmer to convert either out of agriculture or maybe, you know, in some cases, Blythe and the Imperial Valley are going to be asked to retire land because we're over extracting water from the Colorado River as well. So there's this opportunity to kind of put that puzzle together. As agricultural lands are retired, maybe those are the opportunities to put the solar farms because you don't damage the habitat.
And when you say damage the habitat, when you have these installations in these places and quote unquote habitat is disturbed, are they talking about one or the other of both or both of habitat for wildlife? You talk about the tortoises and so forth, are not necessarily Beatty in Nevada, but are different areas worried about they want things left absolutely pristine and, you know, natural? Or is it they want to be able to tear it up with an ATV and have a dirt bike track? And there's cultural imperatives and there's preferences they have that are not necessarily in harmony with nature. Is it a combination of both?
It is a combination of multiple factors. Partly because the public lands system, which is managed by the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of Interior, is the one federal agency without a mission. Meaning the National Park Service has a mission to provide park services and get people to see nature. The Forest Service has a mission to manage sustainable yield of forests in some places and manage wildernesses in others. But the Bureau of Land Management has multiple priorities. Conservation is one of them, but energy development is another, mining is another, recreational ATV use is another. So in some ways, this controversy embodies the challenges faced by this federal agency since it was developed. You know, the history of that agency is the General Land Office was a federal agency that gave away land for development, the Homestead Act. As the West was settled, the General Land Office offered out these lands for if you know you were going to develop these lands and work them, farm them, you could have it. And the desert areas were not farmable. So the General Land Office could never give away these lands. In fact, in the 1920s, the Bureau of Land Management tried to give away lands back to the states, and that didn't happen. So the General Land Office gets merged with a grazing agency. And that's the land that the Bureau of Land Management manages today. It's the nation's largest landlord. It manages 250 million acres across the West. And it manages for all these different activities. Take the desert tortoise again for an example. The desert tortoise, we spend more money conserving that species than grizzly bear, bald eagle, and gray wolf combined. So that species, we make a lot of federal investments in it. And on the flip side, we've now permitted somewhere on the order of 10 gigawatts of solar on public lands. That's more than any other state has. So that means that there's this kind of inevitable clash of conservation because those lands were never developed. And the Energy Policy Act of 2005 is actually the biggest energy law that we had until this most recent Inflation Reduction Act. So the Energy Policy Act of 2005 mandated that the Bureau of Land Management develop for solar. And the idea there was partly, hey, we've been giving out public lands for coal, oil, and gas for all these years. Now it's the solar and other renewables industries' turn to have the public lands.
Professor Dustin Mulvaney, if you're enjoying this conversation, don't keep it to yourself. Tell a friend and follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Dustin Mulvaney shares a potential way to move forward for the communities that will be affected by solar expansion.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing. Dustin Mulvaney's research focuses on the production of emerging technologies and their environmental impact, and specifically, solar energy commodity chains. I wanted Mulvaney to share what, if any, dangerous byproducts we might have to worry about from the expansion of the solar industry.
So solar doesn't seem to have the same level of challenges that batteries do up the supply chain. The key ingredient for a solar panel is quartz. Most of a solar panel is made out of glass. So by weight, quartz goes into that glass. But there's a semiconductor grade quartz that's mined, and that's turned into a very, very pure type of silicon that eventually becomes the wafers that you see in a solar cell. The key metal that is interesting that the solar industry uses is silver. So on a given year, the solar industry uses somewhere around 15% of the global silver supply, which is quite incredible. Now, that is also, interestingly, hasn't led to an increase in silver mining, partly because of the photo industry going away. Silver was widely used in developing photographs, and that supply basically now has kind of slid over to the solar industry, not the direct supply, but has basically substituted that demand over time. So a solar panel is a somewhat simple technology, which poses some challenges for recycling. So that means that like the solar panel is not very valuable inside. Problematic elements that are in a solar panel might be lead at the end of its life. There's a little bit of lead in the solder. It's not like a television set that has a real lot of lead in it, but that's probably the exposure of concern. For example, if you're recycling solar panels, they've recycled 95% of their solar panels in Europe, by the way.
Cadmium as an element in solar panels, what role does that play?
So there are two major types of solar panels. Most of them, 95% of them, are crystalline silicon. So they rely on that quartz and that very, very refined silicon. There's a different technology, a technology actually that people thought would be more widespread today, which is called thin film. The silicon ones are exceptionally thin, but these thin films are actually like 100 times thinner. They're on the order of 100 nanometers of thickness. And those are the semiconductor layers that generate the electricity. So there's one major manufacturer of cadmium telluride solar panels, and that is a thin film technology that is based on cadmium compounds. So there's no quartz in that technology at all. It's literally a totally different solar technology. The materials are totally different.
Now, in France, where recently they ruled that you have to have a solar on every new parking structure that is built, and we have a little bit of that in this country, without getting too political, where in the triptych of what I understand in terms of the menu of renewable energy, where does geothermal fit in, and does it really work? Is geothermal something, to your understanding, something that only works site-specific, meaning your home? You drill a geothermal well to provide certain resources, heating and cooling, but it only works on a house-by-house basis? Or is there the potential for geothermal to work in a utility sense?
Yeah, so you're describing kind of the two different types of geothermal. There is a household level heating, cooling, geothermal, where there's no electricity generation involved unless there's a heat pump associated with that, which could be the case. Geothermal at the utility scale is very location specific because it's taking very hot steam or hot water and bringing it up to the surface to turn a turbine. So there are some advances that people are talking about, enhanced geothermal, where they essentially go deeper and they may even fracture some rock, some of that heat source rock that's down low, to increase its surface area to get a little more steam out of it. But that is certainly another area that's growing right now. Geothermal power is growing. And it also has a potential to provide some other resources as well. So not just generating electricity from these power plants, but district heating. So you could potentially, so geothermal tends to have a lot of wastewater, cooling water associated with it. So you could potentially deliver, just like we have, you know, our water systems in our under our streets, you could have a geothermal hot water system linked under the seats. In fact, New York City has the largest, I think, district steam system in the
yes.
world. So you could do
yes.
that.
What are some of the byproducts as well? It seems like every time we address a problem, renewable energy is an attempt to address a problem. And every time we do that, not that we have an equivalent number of problems we create, but we create some. What are some of the problems, as far as you're concerned, that the move to solar, that the build-out of the solar future, what are some of the problems that result from that?
Well, there are management issues, as I mentioned, at the end of life, I think, that are important. There are chemical stewardship questions around some of the very easy to deal with chemicals. The industry actually doesn't use extremely toxic materials. It uses materials that could be relatively easily treated, even in regular municipal wastewater treatment facilities in some cases. So I'm not overly worried about that. I'll be honest, I think the big issue is the land issue. You know, mm-hmm. we really are moving from subterranean energy resources where you just build a pad and poke a hole in the ground and get tremendous quantities of dense energy to a very diffuse resource that does require a lot of space.
But as far as I'm concerned, if I may, when you make that point, the first thing that comes to mind for me is you poke a hole in the ground and you have presumably less damage to the crust, if you will, to the exterior. But once that stuff comes out of the ground, it more than makes up for it in the toxicity and the damage it creates.
Absolutely.
We punch a few holes in the ground, or we inject water into rock formations and force gas out with God knows what the byproduct of that is. Who
right.
really knows what the long-term consequences of fracking are? Nobody. But the resultant energy is far more what we want. Do you see it that way?
I agree with that. Where I try to take a little different approach to that is to not think of it as trading off one bad energy for another bad energy. Meaning, it's absolutely the case that even if the worst case land use solar is still better than what we're doing right now in terms of the level of fossil fuel extraction. That's not the question. But the question is how to do it better. Because we have so many other alternatives. That's the one beauty of this solar technology, is that it's the only technology we can live under that generates electricity. It's the only technology that we can integrate into the built environment. It's the only technology that we could easily integrate into agricultural areas. So to some extent, I think the challenge is exactly how you framed it at first, which is that we tend to silo these issues. We're only thinking about solar development from the narrow lens of carbon. We're just like in the past, we'd clean up water. You know, when I lived in New Jersey, I was a site engineer cleaning up MTBE spills. MTBE is an additive in gasoline. And the way we cleaned up the groundwater pollution based on the rules that we were supposed to follow was to put it in the air in New York. So we just shift problems from
right.
you know, water problem to air problem to water problem. Like, we have acid rain from coal, right? That we somewhat solved that problem by taking the acid rain potential out of the air. But now we have solid waste problems and fly ash problems at all these coal-fired power plants because the scrubbers have collected all that toxic stuff and now it's sitting at the coal plant. So with the case of solar, we need to be thinking more than just about like the trade-offs on the carbon question, we need to be thinking about how could we build this in an integrative way where we're thinking about water, we're thinking about land, we're thinking about air pollution at the same time, instead of trying to just solve the carbon problem and then we'll figure out what we'll do about the land problem later.
Typically, for what you'd see on a solar farm, how long do solar panels last? If you're wondering if a material that generates energy is nonetheless baking in the 120 degree sun. A wind turbine is out there in the ocean in salt water. And how long do those last? Let's just stick with solar. Solar panels typically last how long?
A typical solar panel is warranted to last 20 to 25 years. So that's unlike any other products that we really see. And the way the warranties work is that they put out a certain amount of power of their initial amount. So if you have a 100-watt solar panel, it will put out 80 watts by the end of its life, 20, 25 years, because impurities in those very hostile environments on your roof, in the desert, impurities creep into those solar cells, and that's what takes away their ability to generate power over time. However, we've seen solar panels that are operating now 50 years. So we certainly are seeing solar panels that are made very, very well. They go through all sorts of advanced degradation tests, hail tests, corrosion tests, all sorts of tests to make sure that they last a long time. In fact, they have to do those in order to ensure the warranties for the solar panels that they're selling.
What do you think is one step that we can take that you think is triage? We need to do this now. What do we need to do now?
I'll say two things. One, I think community ownership of some of these assets is really critical. So it might not be resolvable in its current situation, but we know that, for example, when ranchers get together and they own the wind farm, no one fights it. No, they all welcome it because they're going to receive direct benefit from that. But I think it's really important to also note that when we're talking about building out solar, the U.S. will need somewhere on the order between 5,000 and 15,000 square miles of solar to power its portion of the grid, according to some modelers. So 5 to 15 square miles. We have 300,000 square miles of brownfields, degraded lands, salt-contaminated agricultural lands. All to say that I feel like this conservation versus solar energy development is a false choice, because I think there is a path forward where we could keep many of the lands that we value for their conservation benefits, for their cultural resources, and find the places where the disturbed lands could be utilized, because we have so much of that already. And we know that those projects don't face any opposition.
Well, I want to say thank you so much. You are so authoritative about this. It's been my great pleasure, truly.
Thank you so much.
My thanks to Dustin Mulvaney and Hilary Angelo. This episode was recorded at CDM Studios in New York City. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Zach McNeese, and Maureen Hoban. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. Our social media manager is Danielle Gingrich. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is brought to you by iHeart Radio.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and open Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now